Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week. That's Monday through Thursday in the United States, and because we broadcast live from the future in New Zealand, it is Tuesday through Friday. And my very special guest joining me today is the one, the only, the distilled water, Mr. Bill Still. Here he is. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Now, could you, for those who are unaware of your work, give us a little bit of a backgrounder about who you are and what it is you do.
Oh, man. Well, I started out public life, I guess, in 1990 when I wrote a book called World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, which was a big bestseller here in the United States, sold about 250,000 copies. And then I wrote a book a couple years later, my first book on the economic situation. And that turned into my first documentary, which I guess everybody really knows about, The Money Masters. And subsequently, I've written a lot of other books and in 2010, did The Secret of Oz, which won Best Documentary of 2010 at one international film festival, won many other prizes at other film festivals. And my latest book is called... what's it called? No More National Debt.
Hey, have you noticed that even if you win a documentary festival or anything like that, the money system just still hasn't bloody changed? The information's out there and it's just so obvious to those who have actually done the study on it, and yet the system is, let's just say, it's capable of protecting itself. Like the human body is capable of rejecting a virus, the financial system is capable of rejecting reason, morality, and conscience.
I don't know. I'd have to think about that. That's a pretty well thought out statement. But for me, it's in a way a curse that keeps on giving and a gift that keeps on giving, because the guys who this is basically a multi-trillion dollar per year counterfeiting scam that spans virtually. And, the people who are making the money off of this can afford to spend many billions of dollars keeping the rest of us confused. And so that's pretty much what it is. I'm sort of like Don Quixote. I just keep slapping in the air, hoping to gain sufficient momentum to get this thing turned around. And I think we're getting close. We're getting close in Iceland. We're getting close in Greece. We're getting close in Israel. I know just from having been on this quest for about 20 years now that especially internationally, the level of knowledge about the debt money system and the evils of it is growing very rapidly.
Do you believe that we're close to hitting this kind of critical mass? The way I look at it is it's more or less a war of attrition, that it's a sort of a constant battle that's been waged throughout history. And every now and again, the good guys win, but then the bad guys just come back a little later once the good guys think everything's all over. And, oh, that's in the past, mate, that's in the past. There's no such thing as slavery and tyranny, you know, we got rid of that. Humankind just got over the desire for world domination. We're just over it, bro.
Well, you know, the founding fathers of the United States spoke to that, and that is the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And that's really true. You can't just become free and then, like, you don't have to do anything else. We have something. Freedom is a hard thing humankind to achieve, and as part of making freedom sustainable, also have to have teaching it to our children and grandchildren something that's sustainable as well. Or within just a generation, we can lose.
Bill, I'm sorry, you're breaking up there quite a bit. Would you mind just turning your webcam off, and we'll just proceed with this one on audio there? Just click the little camera button. That should sort it out. Now, for the listening audience, I wanted to also iterate that not only has Bill kind of really encapsulated how this financial system began, but you've kind of chronicled the battle against these against this sort of fiat currency system and the bankers who more or less control it for quite some time. You say you've been in this for 20 years. Can I ask, who was your inspiration? Who did you... like when I go in and I commit activism of some description, usually there's somebody who inspired me and somebody whose material that I used in my initial start off in order to sort of get the information across as it had been given to me. Who was your inspiration? What was your motivation?
Well, there was really no one person. I was... running a newspaper in Northern Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., about 1980, when an old guy called me up and said, "Boy, have I got a story for you. There's no gold left in Fort Knox." And when you run a newspaper, you get crank callers, you know, frequently. And so I developed a response to get them off the phone quickly, because these guys will literally suck every minute of your time out of your day if you let them do it. So I just developed a response and said, "Oh, that's great. Send me something in the mail." And the crazy people would never have anything to send. And, you know, the few people who did, you know, it was worth some serious attention. And so this guy, a couple days later, I got a thick sheaf of papers in the mail. And he was not crazy. He had correspondence trails between himself and the secretary of Treasury, the director of the Bureau of Mint, his whole congressional delegation, et cetera, et cetera. So I had to start investigating. And I wrote up the story as best I could, but I couldn't really figure out why would the U.S. government do such a thing that was so obviously wrong that any reporter looking at it would go, "Wow, this is a big story." And so it just took me a long time to figure it out. It took me, 10 years? No, it took me 12 years to really figure it out before I wrote my first book on the topic, On the Horns of the Beast, the Federal Reserve, and the New World Order. And as you go back through history, you start to see little bits and pieces of this. And as I said before, the guys who were profiting from this multi-trillion dollar per year scam can afford to spend many billions of dollars per year keeping this all covered up. And so you don't have to go back very far before you get behind that smoke screen and you can start to see. And so, guys like Abraham Lincoln made quotes on this. His Secretary of Treasury, whose name I forget right now, made some excellent quotes. The 1923 winner of the Nobel Prize, Frederick Soddy, made many quotes on this. There have been numerous politicians throughout the United States, and really the only times we've really beaten back this debt money system, to my knowledge in any case, have been three times here in the U.S., and they, of course, won it back in 1913 with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. So to answer your question, no one person. I just went back and I started seeing pieces of it cropping up through history. And then I looked deeper and deeper. And education has a couple people who figure it out and try to get the word out. And that's really been it. And so I was determined to try to create a trail of breadcrumbs that was much more robust than the trail that I had to follow. And so I've tried to document it as well as I could. I've tried to sort facts from fiction. I've even caught myself and corrected myself when I fell victim to some of the fake quotes that are rampant within this study. And so that's pretty much how it came about.
Well, you're up against an effective disinformation and misinformation campaign that is incredibly well financed, and you've got I'm guessing virtually zero budget. And have you ever noticed that when it comes to funding, if you're doing the right thing, if you're helping humanity, and you're more or less opposing evil in a very general kind of way, the amount of funding that becomes available to you is usually not quite as much if you've got the direct opposite intention. Like, hey, I want to really weaponize something. I want to kind of like just create a virus that could just wipe out the human race. Who wants to fund me? You get all these guys, yeah, I'll give you $1 billion. I'll give you $1 billion. I want to help the human race and actually give them a sense of purpose and understanding about the world and make sure that they can fulfill their own potential and their own destiny in order to help each other and survive as a free human race rather than being slaves. Who wants to fund me? Well, dead silence.
There's a reason for that, because when you do that, what you're doing is you're trying to maximize human freedom. And what does that mean? That means support deconsolidation of power, no matter where it crops up. You know, you're never going to see people taking to the streets and saying, give our government more power. You know, whenever you see demonstrations in the streets, it's, you know, trying to take power back from an overbearing government. I mean, this is humankind's natural struggle for freedom. And yeah, there's absolutely no money. I've always said in my mantra, one of my mantras has been, there's no money in monetary reform. Absolutely not. So I have to work side jobs, and I've been through a bankruptcy, and you know what, I don't even go through it, but there's no money in monetary reform. Let's put it that way.
I love the irony of that statement, by the way. There's no money in reforming the money supply.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the biggest ripoff in the history of humankind. It is literally a multi-trillion-dollar theft from we the people. It is the world's primary cause of most of the world's hunger, poverty, misery, and disease. Do you think wiping that out is going to be an easy task? No, I don't think so.
Keep going.
Your turn.
I'm sorry, I'm just in the middle of breakfast as well. I'm extremely unprofessional. You may have noticed. The other thing that I found about the financial system is that it promotes those who are corrupt in specificity, because if you want to provide a corrupt system with a, let's just say, an inexhaustible supply of meat, you need to ensure that people are there to protect it. You know, these are the white blood cells of the financial system creature, I think. And who do you think are probably the biggest opposition, like the most dangerous men or organizations when it comes to protecting the financial fraud of the system?
Well, surprisingly, that's a good question. Enough, I'm going to have a different answer for you than you might expect, and that is, I think the most damaging thing to us monetary reformers are the gold bugs, the people that believe that a return to a gold-backed money is the answer to all our problems, because a lot of people believe it. And when I started out into this, I believed it too. And it was only as I kept reading, I found that no, gold isn't really the answer. Gold is actually the problem. And, but we were on a gold-only money system here in the United States during the 1920s. What did we see? We saw did it control the quantity of money? Absolutely not. We saw the roaring 20s, the greatest expansion of the money supply on a percentage basis in the history of the United States. And that's saying something, considering the last 10 years. We were on a gold-only money supply during the Great Depression of the 1930s, where we saw the greatest depletion of the money supply in the history of the United States. Did gold help us then? No, it absolutely did not. It merely provides cover for those who... I'll tell you why. If we went on a gold-only money system tomorrow, would banks stop making loans tomorrow? Would they stop making mortgage loans? Absolutely not. All of our money is created as an interest-bearing debt every time you walk into a bank and take out a loan. They have permission. They don't have the money. They have the permission to counterfeit the money at the instant you sign that paper. When you go in for a loan and you sign that paper, does the banker go back in the vault and pull out a giant Santa Claus bag of $100 bills and plop it on the desk and say, go thy merry way? No. What he does is create an account in your name and put little digits in that account. He's not giving you actual money. He's just giving you digits. He's actually at that instant given the permission by your government to counterfeit your nation's money supply at interest. They've got the gall to not only charge the interest, but if you don't make the payments on this fraudulent loan, then they have the right to confiscate your property, your collateral. So they make money three ways. No, they make money another way. The most important way is by lending, doing the same process to your government, convincing your government that it has to borrow money also. Then they have the political power of the politicians, because the borrower for sure becomes servant to the lender.
I mean, yeah. Hey, pay off your mortgage. Well, what happens if I don't pay off my mortgage? Well, we'll take your fucking house. You go, okay, well, I better pay my mortgage then. So, same banker goes to the government. You've got to keep loaning money. And you go, well, what happens if I stop loaning money? Well, we're going to crash the economy. And everybody's going to be out in the streets. And they're probably going to be really pissed off with you. Because, you know, and they'll hang you from the highest tree. And then we'll just bribe another puppet and put them in place.
My retort is, why would a government borrow when a government can create? Why would you do that?
If it's beholden to scumbaggery, I mean, you're just taking a stab in the dark here. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's no scumbaggery. I get this kind of impression as well from I don't know. Have you noticed how there's all these labels and everything that you chuck around? The elite, the ruling class, the new world order, the such and such, and the blah, blah, blah. And for such a long time, the mere mention of these words has almost been punishable by ridicule, you know, and in fact, to a large extent, it still is. And it comes down to this, narrowing it down to who and what exactly is at the center of this big corporate global banking tarantula that holds the web in its hands.
The people who have the privilege to counterfeit money. That is the biggest ripoff in the history of creation. I know what you're trying to get at. You're trying to get me to say, oh, it's the Rothschilds. And you know what? If you went out and arrested every Rothschild and every Rockefeller in the world tomorrow, would your bank stop lending mortgage loans tomorrow?
For me, it's mostly about individuals rather than families. I mean, sure, there's Rothschilds involved in central banking, there's Warburgs, there's Rockefellers and what have you, but a friend of mine was saying the other day, but I know somebody who's a Rothschild and they're not a scumbag. And I go, well, it's under the proviso that it's usually just the Primarchs, usually them alone, who are actually engaging on behalf of scumbaggery. They are carrying the family name. And most members of families are very, very different. You look at any brother or sister, and you'll see that they're completely different. Even though they were raised by the same parents in the same home with the same conditions and the same opportunities, they develop relatively massive differences in their personality. So, yeah, I agree with you as well. I'm sick of all these people just labeling the Rothschild family and all of this kind of thing. What I'm talking about is specific individuals who actually have a track record.
The point is, we're never going to fix it if we're focusing on individuals and the Rothschilds, et cetera, et cetera. When that's what's impossible to fix. What is possible to fix is what they're doing to us. And if everybody in your country understood tomorrow morning what was going on when they go in and sign that mortgage note, there would be a revolution overnight, and suddenly New Zealand would be transformed into a financial paradise.
However, with the misinformation and disinformation campaigns, the mainstream media, and also all the people that are in the bank's pockets, like I'll tell you an example. I had a billionaire in New Zealand called Alan Hubbard. Now, the Minister of Justice, Mr. Simon Power, unlawfully, without any evidence of any kind, mind you, put his company, South Canterbury Finance, was the largest finance company still standing in the country, under statutory management by the government for fraud. Now, every time you go under investigation for fraud, what happens to your stocks? So guess what? The bank that does the government's banking here in New Zealand is Westpac, which is an Australian bank. And Westpac turned out to be the prime beneficiary for the receivership in South Canterbury Finance's assets. And then Simon Power got promoted. He actually left government and went directly to be the head of corporate banking for Westpac. And about 2 years later, it was announced in probably the bottom of the paper that this big fraudulent company, this giant Ponzi scheme, this huge media campaign about it, managed to somehow return 96% of investors' money. So when I think about the financial system, I think about lots of inputs, throughputs, corruption, individuals, connections, and things of that nature. And often it's those that are in the position of power that have the power to make decisions. And so simultaneously, do not those people need to be exposed? But exactly as you're saying, the entire system needs to be understood by the whole of the general public in order to change it with any, rigidity. Otherwise, it'll simply regrow itself like a cancer that's been removed and then keeps getting fed really dangerous stuff.
Well, my point is that you can't pick them off one by one, because number one, they're a big pack and they understand that they have to protect each other to protect the secret. And so even if you manage to take one down, which is very difficult, you can expend many people's energies, which could be much better spent by, instead of going after the individual, going after what they're doing. It's such an obvious fraud, and you can explain it, and that's been my life mission, is to figure out how to explain this in terms simple enough that someone like me can even understand it. I'm not the sharpest knife in the deck here, and so it takes me a long time. I'm a very slow reader, and it takes me a long time to figure this stuff out. But once I get it, I can lock on to it and reduce it into terms that the average person can understand. And that's really my one skill in life, I think.
Well, hence the success of your documentaries, because you talk to anybody about finances or any of that kind of stuff, the eyes glaze over, because it's such complicated nonsense to a large degree, or at least that's how the mainstream media seems to portray it every time I've seen them talk about it. It's just like tables and figures, doesn't mean anything. And I think there was a quote, I don't remember who did it, but for every 100 people that are striking at the branches of tyranny, there is only one who strikes at the root.
Very good. I've never heard that one before, but that is quite illustrative of what the problem is. People tend to want to strike at the branches, and it's just a big old waste of time.
Yeah, you're actually probably right. So let's think about this. The key here, at least the impression that I'm starting to get, is public awareness. Without public awareness, it matters not what attempts you make, what organizations you have or anything, because the public will be in the pockets of the bankers and the others who won't want you to know the truth. They'll just spread out their misinfo and disinfo campaigns. And it's because of not only yourself, but people like G. Edward Griffin and, Gerald Celente, who've been starting to do exactly the same thing, which is bring the understanding of the complex financial system down to a level of comprehension that the public can grasp. I think that the only reason why this has been such a well-kept secret for such a long time is because of its complexity, because of people's inability to reduce the complexity into only a few sentences to fit within their 7 to 30 second attention span.
Well, G. Edward Griffin has certainly done nothing to remove the clouds of confusion from this topic. He has been a gold bug from the word go. His book, whatever it's called, Creature from Jekyll Island or whatever, it has done some very interesting research. And before that, Griffin did some excellent documentaries. However, he got on to the gold solution as the the cure to our economic woes, and he's just dead wrong. And he's attacked me personally on a website that he put up devoted just to attacking me. And so we're not friends.
Nonetheless, the creature from Jekyll Island did expose at least to how the Federal Reserve system got set up. And my philosophy is it's on the points we agree that we should come together and collaborate. The points we disagree, we can usually leave those debates for another time, preferably a time when we're not under the threat of enslavement and maybe extermination by ruthless criminal sociopathic elites. But at the same time, what was it I was saying the other day? If you don't criticize people based upon their character, like if you choose other aspects and things of that nature, then you always wind up attacking people of good conscience who just don't understand what they're doing to a large degree, rather than striking at the psychopathic bullies who seek to divide and conquer us all. But yeah, heaps of people in the truth movement I found have fights. I mean, you must have noticed this. Who was it that was saying? Mike Montagna, yeah, him. He was like had this rig rant about you and how you stole all his work and all of this kind of shit. And I'm just sitting there, kind of like, yeah, exactly. Just kind of like,
you know, I'd never heard of that guy until about 2 years ago, and everybody says Mike Montagna is saying that you stole his work, and you know, I think I've seen one of his YouTubes of this rant just, you know, when I was first alerted to this, but I have no idea who the guy is or what he's about.
Yeah, yeah. And I find that that's what happens is like, let's just say the truth drives certain people nuts because they're not willing to accept the truth about themselves. Right? And,
well,
and if you focus it externally and you blame everybody else, and you don't kind of do that sort of self-analysis and sit there and go, you know, am I being a bit of a dick today? I think I am. I better do something to change it.
You know, still, you just can't underestimate the damage that the gold bug philosophy is causing, because, you know, they're trying to say, well, if only we return to gold, which is never going to happen, you know, then we can solve all our problems. And so... And these people outnumber we monetary reformers like 50 to 1 here in the United States. And every one of the alternative radio shows, such as yours, but here in the States, who are their major sponsor? Absolutely, without question, it is gold dealers. And so will the host ever, you know, come out against a return to gold? No, I mean, all the gold dealers are still saying, oh, gold's down to under $1,100 an ounce. It's fallen $700. It's fallen 40% in the last 3 years. This is a great time to throw all your money in. You know, and maybe it is, but, you know, on the other hand, it is just not the solution. The solution is very easy. And that's why I've tried to boil it down to one sentence, and that is no more national debt. The number one thing that we have to do is prevent our governments from borrowing, because then governments become beholden to the lenders. And no matter what kind of noise you make, you're never going to get members of the government to pass legislation which will effectively deal with this problem, as long as they're borrowing from the same people they're supposedly, you know, slapping down.
Ladies and gentlemen, applause now. Exactly. Fucking exactly. And I think, can I ask you something? Have you gotten through any, like, personal trauma over this, you know? Like sitting there, you know, these days when you're like, you're so angry and you're so frustrated at the situation that you see that it's you kind of need to take a couple of days off, that kind of thing?
No, I've been doing it for too long. I've done thousands of interviews on this over the years. I mean, I stopped counting at 2,500 interviews, and that was 10 years ago. So I've heard all the arguments, and I pretty much have, you know, I'm able to come up with the right answer no matter what the question is, so it doesn't bother me.
Well, you certainly be working it well then. Okay, well, let's break it down a little bit further then. You know how this all started, you know how the players are kind of irrelevant. It's, What was it that I was saying before? Sometimes when you're playing against a rigged game, the only way to win it is to leave. So no national debt. How exactly do we achieve that? Is this with social credit, interest-free currency backed by the government?
Backed by the government. Well, see, I don't even like the term backed, because money doesn't need to be backed by anything. It just the implication of saying the money is backed by something makes that something capable of being purchased by the richest guys in the world club, so they can control the quantity of money instead of we the people controlling. It is a nation's most important power is the ability to issue your own money without debt and control its quantity for the benefit of we the people instead of them the bankers. That's the most important responsibility of a government. You can't even defend your nation if you don't have this capability, because if the banking class is controlling the quantity of your money supply, then they can create boom times or bust times. And history has shown that they don't do it for our benefit, we the people. The banking class does it solely for their benefit to get their way politically. And so therefore, we lose our democratic, we lose our ability to actually control our own political future. And isn't that what everybody's complaining about and bitching about? But they just don't know, they can't get their arms around exactly what the problem is. They just know that they're not in control.
I want to float something by you then. A friend of mine came up to me and he was like printing his own currency, just making it up and just printing it out and then using it for exchange. You would just negotiate with them and just go, I can give you some of these dollars and all of that kind of stuff. And actually people start to take his money, right? And they actually start to give it value and that sort of thing. And we have communities down here in New Zealand that have like community dollars that the town actually prints themselves up, and they use that for a lot of the trading and financing in their town, that kind of thing. I don't know exactly what would the new system be like. Okay, so what the system's currently like is you've got a central bank that prints money out of nothing. They don't even print it. They just make it up on a computer. And then you have all the subsequent banks down the line who just make money up out of thin air based upon people's signature. Let's change that. Is there going to be a central bank, or is it, or would we do away with central banks completely?
Well, I mean, actually, you could call it a central bank and just have it do the correct functions, and that's basically as per direction of your democratically elected legislature, control the quantity of money in circulation for the benefit of the general public instead of for the benefit of the banking class. And as far as, you know, you're talking about a complementary currency there in New Zealand, and I don't know what the exact federal laws are there, but here in the United States, when Bitcoin first hit, that's exactly why the U.S. government couldn't crack down on Bitcoin, because during the Great Depression of the 1930s, there were over 3,000 complementary currencies that sprang up in the United States. Just when people don't have any money at all, they'll make up something to be money. I mean, it's just the way it is. And so that's why Bitcoin took off. And so complementary currencies are not a bad thing, but you still need one federal money that's quote-unquote good for the payment of taxes, and you still need taxes in some way or another, if for no other reason than if the quantity of money got to be too big, there's only one way to destroy it, and that's by taxation. You put some taxes on something, anything, doesn't really matter, and when it's paid back to the government, as long as the government was the one who issued it in the first place, then that money is destroyed. It's not put back into circulation, and therefore you can regulate the quantity. When I did the Money Masters, I was in consultation with probably the greatest economist of the last 100 years, Milton Friedman, and he generously offered to take a look at the Money Masters and critique it for me. And I'll never forget when he called me back on a Monday morning, and He said, boy, if you don't do anything about fractional reserve lending, you've done nothing. Because I was still on this thing that Ron Paul later got onto, and that is end the Fed. If we just end the central bank, it'll solve all our problems. It won't solve all the problems. If you ended the Fed tomorrow, lenders would still be making mortgage loans the next day, giving you so-called money that they created out of nothing at the instant you signed the note. Until your government creates its own money, and it is the sole creator of that money, so that then banks can only lend out money they actually have, you're never going to fix this problem.
Well, I think the what was it they were saying, that people are like decrying capitalism, saying it's based on endless growth and what have you. What would you say to that in terms of this new banking system? How would it kind of get over that problem?
Well, Friedman's solution to the quantity of money problem, which you know, hits into the growth problem, is that you just keep the quantity of money the same on a per capita basis. That was one way to do it. And then he went into more complex ways, which were over my head. So just that one way has always stuck with me. You know, so you want X amount of money per capita in the system, and as population naturally grows or doesn't grow, right now we're actually, if it wasn't for illegal immigration in the United States, our population would actually be in decline. And so, you know, possibly humanity is actually going to top out and just naturally end the great growth cycle, or whatever you want to call it.
I would call it the Great Recession.
Well, whatever. That's Friedman's idea of dealing with the ever-expanding role of money.
I wondered as well, who's accumulating all this wealth? Because I think that the system is sort of predicated to funneling it all into the coffers of the banks, more or less. You know, they can create money out of thin air. I can just create $100,000 by typing a keyboard. And if I wanted to work and earn that $100,000, it would take me, I don't know, several years. And that's not including survival, right? And somebody asked me once, you know, hey, why do you think the banks are in control of everything, Vinny? And I go, well, it's pretty obvious. Have a look at any major metropolitan city. Who's got the largest buildings? The banks.
Right.
Who's got the newest buildings? The banks.
Right.
Who's got the most lavish offices and all the best security and everything? The banks. So who's got most of the money, and who creates it, and who controls it, and who's benefiting from the current paradigm? Pretty obvious.
And using that money to prevent any effective legislation from eliminating their ability to continue on with this counterfeiting racket.
Well, that's another thing. Being able to is there some kind of what was it you talking about? The Logan Act, for example, preventing members of state from consulting with private corporations without prior state approval because of the corruption that it breeds. I would wonder. What does lobbying come into that equation there? Is lobbying like just basically a form of pseudo-corruption?
Yeah, it's not pseudo-corruption even. It's we have done absolutely nothing to tackle the lobbying problem here in the United States. And so this is just going to go on unabated until the way this stranglehold is going to be broken is some brave nation is finally going to get fed up and do the right thing. And,
no pun intended.
Yeah, and then start issuing their own money without debt, and the big bankers will try to strangle them, and they'll go, hey, we're free of your system. We can issue all this money we want, and there's nothing you can do about it. And their economy will start to thrive because the debt burden will be gone. And plus the political control by the bankers will be gone. And so therefore the system will automatically start operating in the public interest. And in fact, that's how the American colonies back at their foundation got going. Immigrants came here, there was very early on, there was no gold. There were no silver mines. So by definition, had to become this hotbed of monetary inventiveness. And what did they invent? They just invented complementary currencies, just like you guys do in New Zealand, just like everybody tends to do worldwide whenever they need money. And actually, the thing that caused the Revolutionary War, according to Ben Franklin, was not, as he put it, a little tax on tea or other matters, but that Great Britain commanded that Americans needed to start paying their taxes in gold, and nobody had any gold. So it caused an instant a depression in the United States, and that was the real cause of the American Revolution. So hopefully one of these countries, Israel, Iceland, will do the right thing, and I think probably Iceland is the most far advanced, will do the right thing, and then other nations will see, hey, well, Iceland is doing pretty well, you know, and they dropped out of this debt money system. And then and only then are we going to crack this.
I've seen a number of nations try to do something different to that, or even just with oil. Iraq tried to trade oil for, euros, gets invaded. Gaddafi tries to trade oil for gold dinars, gets invaded. And then I think it's just like, as soon as you start to kind of get as a nation, and I'm not sure how this would happen with Iceland or basically, if you're in a white nation, it's pretty likely that the US isn't going to invade you, you know, because it would be a massive PR nightmare, wouldn't it? It's just like, okay, how do we get white people to hate other white people? Damn. We just can't do it. It doesn't matter how many terrorists you finance locally and give 2,000 brand new SUVs from and finance through the CIA or anything like that. No matter how many fake Muslim terrorists that you get through recruited in your CIA mind control programs and what have it. Doesn't matter. You can't really do that because people won't put up with NATO invading Iceland or NATO invading the United States. You know, or will they?
Well, I mean, that's just not the case. I mean, they did everything they could to strangle Iceland. And fortunately, the Icelanders are actually Vikings, and they tend to get angry. And so when the IMF made its demands on Iceland, that would basically mean that Iceland had to repay for a period of 10 years basically their entire GDP output, which was the IMF's solution to the Icelandic banking crisis. The people, it was passed through the parliament, and the people took to the streets, demanded a referendum, and voted it down by 94% to 6. So, you know, the Icelanders have already been through this. They're not scared. I think they understand the basis of the problem. And the guy driving it in Iceland right now is a guy by the name of Frosti Sigurjonsson, who is a member of parliament. And he's a really sharp guy. I mean, he speaks English without an accent. He was the head of IBM in Iceland for a number of years, and he is just absolutely dedicated to making this happen in Iceland. I don't know if it'll take a year, 2 years, 10 years, but he will make it happen before he goes to his grave.
It occurs to me that there's going to be a lot of misinformation and disinformation about Iceland. Have you witnessed any of this?
Oh, yeah. Well, previously, I mean, the IMF said, yeah, if Iceland goes ahead and votes down our offer, then they'll never get credit again, you know, as long as they live. Well, they voted it down. They implemented their own plan of fixing it. And 2 years later, the internal IMF memo was leaked saying, how do we get Iceland to start borrowing money from us again? So that's the way it goes.
And also, I found that Iceland is out of the news. I haven't heard anything on the news about Iceland, like almost at all. So if you can't disinform or misinform the public about it, just don't inform them about it at all. That seems to be the tactic. And if they get too rowdy, if they get too popular, if you can't ignore them and you can justify it, yeah, just invade them, you know, why not? Or better yet. Trap them with a trade deal. That's actually something I wanted to talk to you about. I'm not sure what your area of interest is with this, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TTIP, the Transatlantic Financial Scumbaggery, or whatever the hell it's called.
Yeah, I'm up to speed on both. I mean, and you know, it falls within the general category of being over consolidation of power. And you really, you need to observe the sovereignty of nation states, because once you have too much of a legal or political burden going above the sovereign nation state, nothing but bad things are going to happen. People love their nation states, and they're just not going to buy into an international authority. For example, Great Britain, being a member of the EU, though not a member of the Euro, has suddenly found that 80% of their laws are no longer made by the British Parliament. They're made by the European Parliament in Brussels. And so this is a hot issue, and it's going to come to a vote here in Britain within a year. And that could really be a big crack in the second crack in the diet after Greece. And so hopefully that little bit of consolidation of power will come down. Now, whether or not we're going to be able to turn that back, turn the TPP, turn Congress against the TPP in the United States is another question. They granted Obama fast-track authority by a single vote, and so now he has the ability to try to ram TPP once it's through its negotiation phase through the U.S. Congress, and hopefully we're going to be able to stop it.
I see a multifaceted consolidation of power coming from a number of different directions. Trade's one, finances is another, and one that's been sort of like popping up on my radar a lot lately is climate change. I wrote the status this morning. If you think that the UN global government and carbon tax model is a bad idea, then you're on the right track. But you've still not worked out that environmentalism, in quotation marks, is being used by the same elites who caused all the pollution and literally forced human culture into consumerism and detachment from the natural order to convince people that they are the evil ones and that it's our freedoms that are to blame, as opposed to the evil scumbags who own 90% of the world's resources and have all the courts, politicians, and media in their back pockets.
Right, i.e. Al Gore. So
I love it. What was it? Al Gore actually created a company with a guy named Blood, and they made a company to trade carbon credits called Blood and Gore. I thought that was classic. And then he bought Waterfront Property. you can't make this stuff up.
Well, whatever. And like you say, it's a multi-pronged attack, and humanity is just going to have to respond as best they can. Once our generation goes, I just fear for the millennial generation. I have children myself, and they're in that millennial generation. They just seem to me woefully, even though they're my kids, woefully unprepared to take on, the ever more complex burden that these schemes are taking on. I don't know what's going to happen, but I assume some of them are going to figure it out and rise up and carry the flag for the others.
Well, I think Suzanne Posel from the U.S. Independent made a very good point about the millennial generation. She did this big study and basically, you know how they do meta studies, you study studies, you know, and it seemed as though there's a triple gen sort of track record. So every third generation is considered sort of like a millennial generation, right? And those millennial generations are usually responsible for all the revolutions that happened through history, a lot of the massive big cultural changes, those huge switches. It's those generations that force those things into fruition. The second generation back, which would be the baby boomers, are usually the ones that sort of lapse into this sort of false sense of security and more or less have a sense of entitlement, and they more or less just sort of keep society on a gradual slope, not a whole lot changes. And the one before then is just after the revolutions generally, and life's very, very tough, and everybody's sort of grossly independent, and it grows these strong institutions which wound up dominating the next generation of baby boomers to come, and then getting overthrown by the millennials and the generation that come after that. So it's a human generational cycle, and if you look throughout history and all the revolutions and everything that have happened, it happens but almost without fail every third generation or so, which I find very interesting, because throughout history everybody said, oh, these kids, they're so disrespectful, they ain't got any stuff. And I've just noticed at the age of 30 that I'm starting to do that, you know, like 17, 18 year old kids or something like that arguing with me on Facebook, you know, and I'm almost going to start to add the word whippersnapper to my regular vocabulary, because it's just so awesome.
Or you can just abbreviate it WS.
I usually use abbreviations for things that actually involve cussing when I can't actually cuss, but generally if you cuss a lot, it tends to mean that you're a bit more honest. Sometimes. Anyway, some people just swear all the time and happen to be scumbags. And I was thinking about this as also fear, right? The fear to change, the fear to let go of these things that are dominating you and actually wanting to do something about and wanting to risk it all. I kind of risked everything in order to do what I'm doing now for one main reason. I didn't have a choice. You ever noticed that? It's when your conscience compels you to the point where you feel like you do not have a choice. You cannot live with yourself unless you take action, unless you risk everything that you've got. You believe that you've got nothing.
So let me ask you, what did you do before this show?
I was a really annoying telemarketer. I was number one in the company for 6 months solid with the top sales record. I was making, I don't know, $700 a week for only 10 hours work after tax. And then I got promoted a couple of times, and every single boss that I had tended to be a psycho who didn't really care about me or the customer's well-being or any of the employees or anything. And so I wound up either getting fired for trying to change the company to a more positive route, or quitting because they wouldn't. And I think my last paycheck was, I don't know, like 15, 16 grand after tax for the month's work. And I was just like, okay, I got enough. I'm quitting. Just got myself a camera and a computer. And I've been exposing scumbaggery and helping activists get the word out because the mainstream media won't ever since.
Very good story. Well, you're very good with ad-libbing. That's something I could never do. I've been offered radio shows, but always turned them down just because I'm not well enough spoken. The only way I can really get it going is when I get mad and start talking fast, and then my brain gradually creaks into gear. But you're very good.
I get that a lot. In fact, who was it? The economic hitman, John Perkins. I got a clip of him saying, "There's a lot of people who do what you do, Vinny, but you're the best." I was like, whoa, I need to try and control my ego a little bit much, because that might go to my head. And what it is, I think it's just mostly just being genuine, more or less, and also that very intensive training over a couple of years, being able to call somebody out of the blue while they're having dinner, interrupt them from having dinner, from a company that they've never heard of, and be able to get them to change their phone accounts to this company and get them to dislike their current one within a very, very short time frame, and usually having that between 7 or 30 seconds to grab the attention and the thing. So it's more or less trained me into this mode, or at least I found it very, very useful in this, particularly the capacity to take large quantities of garbage, convoluted garbage, and simplify it in a manner that's comprehensible to somebody who has very little or no experience in the data itself. And that's kind of it. And in terms of you doing a radio show, it sounds to me like you simply need what's his name, Howard Stern. You know how Howard Stern has a co-host? You needed like a female co-host, bro, to like be there, be that like fluffy, bubbly, oh, it's so nice and whatever, while you're telling everybody that they're screwed. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, Bill, and I want to thank you very much for coming on with me, and I don't think you've got another hour to give me, so we'll have to let you go now. And what's your website real quick before we go?
Sure, it's billstill.com.
BillStill.com, ladies and gentlemen, and it's been like that for quite a while. Thank you. Still, you know, it. God, I'm so bad with the jokes. It's not as bad as the truth, though. That's really just awful stuff. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you after the break.